from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
In general, I'd say don't become demoralized. Don't misplace your wrath in the form of petty violence. Channel that wrath into a deep, constructive engagement with winning this culture war.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Peter Wood, author of the recent book, Wrath, America Enraged. We talked at length with Peter about the book. He'll be up in just a few minutes on the program. But first, we're joined now by John J. Miller, director of the Herbert H. Dow II Program in American Journalism at Hillsdale College. John, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show.
We talked, John, just after the college football playoff has wrapped up, and also as the NFL playoffs are about to begin, and there's still an emphasis and an interest in player safety on both of those levels. You wrote a book some time ago called The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. This goes back, of course, to the early 1900s. Today's injuries, today's violence, as bad as it seems, is nothing really compared to what it was, well, 120 years ago or so.
No, it was way worse back then. And it's pretty bad right now. Concussions are a problem. Long-term health effects of head injuries is something that doctors and leagues and everybody studying want to understand how to keep the game safe for players right now. But it's also worth recognizing that a little more than a century ago, the game was much more violent and brutal than it is right now. For example, in the year 1905, 18 players died playing football. And there are many more who had grievous injuries, cracked bones, all kinds of stuff. But 18 people died playing football. And this was at all levels, from kids in sandlot games all the way up to big-time college football. There was no professional football to speak of at the time.
How does Teddy Roosevelt become a part of the football story?
Roosevelt was a great fan of football. In fact, when he was a freshman at Harvard in 1876, he went to the second ever football game played between Harvard and Yale, one of the great rivalries in American sports, and became a fan of the game, grew up enjoying it, never played himself, but as it was becoming more and more popular in the 1880s and 1890s, starting to fill up stadiums on Thanksgiving Day and that sort of thing, he was enjoying it more and more, and he was aware of this problem, that the game was brutal and violent and also incredibly popular. And so by the time he became president, he was trying to think of ways to address this problem, and he took action as president.
Yes, before Roosevelt becomes involved or even becomes president, there's discussions about the violence. Harvard's president, Charles Eliot, plays a role here. He wants to suspend intercollegiate play completely for football among colleges.
So there was this big social and political movement of people who wanted to ban football because of the brutality. And its leader was this guy, Charles W. Eliot, the president of Harvard. And he was probably the most important figure in the history of American higher education, you know, at least before Larry Arnn, of course. but when we think of Harvard as the great quintessential American research university, it's because of this guy, because he was the person who made it so. He was the one who made Harvard the leader in the field of American higher education. Sort of it's a bizarre idea by our way of looking at it, but there's something quaint about it as well. At any rate, he despised the violence in football, and his solution was to ban it. He wanted to get rid of the sport. He wanted Harvard to eliminate it. He couldn't do that because the game was really popular with the students and also the board of trustees, and the alumni liked it. So it was a political dispute on his own campus, but he had the faculty with him, and they wanted to dump. They wanted to dump football from Harvard. Everybody knew that if Harvard got rid of football, a lot of other schools would follow, and that would imperil the sport. And so this concerned people who loved the game and wanted to preserve it.
John J. Miller with us, the author of The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football, also director of the Dow Journalism Program here at Hillsdale College. This discussion about football, does it in some way bring about the creation of the NCAA at that point?
Exactly. So in 1905, when Theodore Roosevelt was president, he summoned to the White House the coaches of the three biggest football programs in America, which were Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. So a lot has changed since then. You know, today it'd be what, Alabama, Clemson, and, you know, some other school.
Yeah.
At any rate, he summons them to the White House, and he says, in a private meeting, he says, football is on trial, and I would like you guys to try and solve its problem with brutality. He didn't tell them what to do. He didn't regard himself as a football man. He was a fan, but he was not a player. He didn't coach, nothing like that. But he said, you guys have a problem, and you need to do something about it. To make a long story short, the season ends, and the Harvard coach was a guy called Bill Reed, and he took Roosevelt seriously and wanted to reform the sport. He also understood that the president of his own college posed a unique threat to the future of football. And so he created a new rules committee that wound up superseding the one that had existed for a long time and one that had resisted reforms to the game. He created a new rules committee that adopted a bunch of features, including making the personal foul a heavily penalized infraction. Mm-hmm. They created a neutral zone at the line of scrimmage. They moved the yardage necessary for a first down from 5 yards to 10. Every one of these things, which we now recognize in the modern game, every one of those reforms was done with an eye toward player safety. The big innovation, though, was they adopted the forward pass. Because up until that time in football, there were quarterbacks, but there were no wide receivers. You could toss the ball backward laterally, but you could not throw it downfield. And people had been talking about this reform for a number of years, and they thought it would make the game safer. They mm-hmm. thought it would open up the game, you'd use right. more of the field, and so on. But it always met with resistance from this old rules committee. Well, Bill Reed's new rules committee adopted the forward pass. And the body that did this, this football rules committee that was invented for this purpose, became the NCAA. And so that's the birth of the NCAA. It's also the birth of this really exciting element. And the miracle of this reform is that it did make the game safer. Within a number of years, the deaths just plummeted. And then 10 years later, nobody was talking about banning football. So this reform, combined with the others, really helped the sport improve and also made it a lot more exciting.
Yeah. John J. Miller with us, director of the Dow Journalism Program at Hillsdale College and author of The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. Final question. We go forward 115 years or so to present day. The NFL has had this ongoing discussion about CTE and head injuries in the league. Popularity of the league seems to be as high as ever. However, youth participation is down. You look at high schools and grade school football participation. Do you think that football has a similar problem today to what they had around 1905, or have they sufficiently addressed what's been happening the past 5-6 years or so?
So there are similarities and differences. The similarities, of course, is that there's this great concern for the safety of players and a desire to do something about it. Lots of differences, of course. Many more people are playing football. Mm-hmm. The game is as popular as it was back then. It's much more popular now. And the threat to it now is not so much from a, you know, people want to ban it. I mean, you do hear that. You do hear these suggestions and so forth that we need to ban the sport. But the real threat, I think, comes from the sorts of decisions that parents
right.
and children and families will make together. In other words, the parents who encourage their young kids to play soccer instead.
John J. Miller, director of the Herbert H. Dow II Program in American Journalism at Hillsdale College and author of The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. Thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Up next, we talk with Peter Wood, author of the recent book Wrath, America Enraged. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can find out more about Hillsdale College at hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Peter Wood. He's president of the National Association of Scholars and also author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged. He also wrote last year's book, 1620, which was featured on the program previously. Peter, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
This book, Wrath, has a very specific title. When you use that word wrath, and perhaps not anger, how do you make that differentiation? What's the difference to you?
Well, I'm making it at several levels. First of all, wrath is a far more intense form of the kinds of political and public anger we've seen in recent decades. But I think it's more than that. The wrath refers to the collision between a suppression of the constitutional liberties and rights of Americans and their sense that no alternative is available to them under the law, that the political process and the courts have shut them down. So with nowhere to turn to with your anger, it turns into a destructive fury, which is what I'm calling wrath. I think there's a collective side to it as well. While, you know, individuals can be very angry and sometimes described as wrathful, wrath invokes the sense of a collective outrage, a body of people who find in common that their rights have been stolen from them.
This is a big question, I think. Is this a permanent change? Has the American populace been changed in a way that could take decades to shift directions? Are we permanently changed?
Well, my pessimistic answer to that is yes, we have. Emotional temperament is not something that can be switched on and off overnight. It is part of what we get through maturation and education. Children grow up in households in which either they are shown and lived through the models of emotional control and temperance, or they don't. If you grow up in an atmosphere in which the prestige adheres to showing how mean you can be, that's the kind of adult you're going to be as well.
Peter, the Trump administration for many Americans served to reveal or help to reveal how corrupt some of the Washington establishment was and is, how corrupt some of the media members are. Does that make this wrath, anger different from past generations?
Yes, I think it did. Well, let's go back to the 1980s with the emergence of talk radio and, you know, the major and largest figure looming over that being Rush Limbaugh, who could play with public anger. And he was frequently a voice of a kind of national scold against the leftist infiltration of the institutions. But he did it in a somewhat jolly way. He was always chuckling and laughing, and that brought along a mass audience. It was an audience that could be inflamed to moments of anger, but didn't stay in a sustained version of anger. If you look back to the early part of the teens of this century with the emergence of the Tea Party movement, again, you had people who were indignant, but they were not enraged. You couldn't call the Tea Party movement a movement of wrath, although you might have seen something like wrath in the Occupy movement, which was a near contemporary of the others.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened with the Trump administration, I think, is that it really did pull the cover down on just how profoundly distorted our lead institutions had become. He showed us that we have a permanent government. He basically took the Angelo Codevilla thesis of deep state and showed it to be true to many people who halfway suspected it but didn't know it for sure. The treatment by the media of Trump's presidency, the indulgence of the phony Russian investigation, showed us that organization of our system of self-government had fallen into the hands of an elite that had no real regard at all for popular sovereignty, for the vote, or for the will of the people, and instead was just going to impose its own will. That was a catastrophe, I'd say, for the elite. They were enraged not only because someone was defying them, but because a spotlight was being put on their ordinary behavior, and that, I think, did set up this moment now of irreconcilable collision.
Is there a component of revenge in American politics today that did not exist in years past?
Well, that's a complex question. I would think if you go back to the Adams versus Jefferson election, you know, we're a country in which a high-spirited reprisal has often been in our politics,
mm-hmm.
and with a country that had a civil war, I wouldn't want to say that revenge has been absent from the American character. John Wilkes Booth himself was an American, after all. But that said, I think it's much more fluidly a revenge tragedy these days, with many more people thinking that it's within their rights to take up against their enemies, chase them into the restroom and harass them in restaurants and things like that. That's revengeful behavior. They're not an argument. They're aiming to humiliate a foe, and the foe is defined as somebody who holds or espouses opinions different from one's own. I don't see that kind of behavior a whole lot on the right, although this public chant at football games of these days against Biden has an element of that. There's a sort of gleeful you're going to shut us up everywhere else, well, you can't shut us up here aspect to it. I don't think that's a great thing, but on the other hand, I appreciate that it's just words, and we're not seeing physical attacks on people. The other side is using physical attacks.
Final question for Peter Wood, author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged. You write that wrath is a dangerous weapon. You must use it wisely to avoid self-injury. So what are your recommendations if this is a semi-permanent state, perhaps, as you alluded to earlier? How do Americans who perhaps feel this way best use that wrath?
I think they use it by forcefully commandeering the law wherever they can. That is, we need to resort to civil disobedience in the form of refusing to abide by unjust edicts. We need to gather as a collectivity rather than being a mass of isolated and demoralized individuals. So we need to speak to each other. We need our own social media, because the social media themselves are now being used to suppress any dissenting opinions. There is a groundswell of organization that takes its most vivid form right now in the flooding of school board meetings across the country by parents who are outraged at seeing the neo-racist agenda being foisted on their children, and transgenderism and other things they find repugnant being implemented in their lives by the force of the state.
Peter Wood, the author of the new book, Wrath, America Enraged, also president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, Kelly Casimir from Hillsdale's Chemistry Department tells us about drug addiction at the atomic level. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Tired of listening to people who are angry all the time?
Try listening to Armstrong and Getty from 9 to noon right after Free Fire Radio.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Remodeled kitchen, bathroom, or backyard patio? There's a lot of choices, but only one leader, Estate Granite.
Mike Huber has such a professional attitude and a can-do work ethic that makes him a joy to work with. Mike and his crew worked to have our new kitchen finished in 5 days. We came back to a true work of art.
Hi, this is Brian Filato, broker and co-owner of The Real Estate Group. In today's competitive market, I think what's important is that the house is dialed in and turnkey. And what's important is that the kitchen has been renovated, the bathrooms have been renovated, granite, beautiful cabinetry. Those things make a significant difference.
Mike at Estate Granite has an eye for detail, an attention to perfection, and a quality build crew that are masters of their craft. Mike was there from start to finish.
Hi, this is Mike from Estate Granite. I know how important quality to a homeowner is, so give me a call at 241-STONE or come by our showroom at 4900 Mountain Lakes Boulevard or visit us at EstateGranite.com.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
A Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Charlie's Place was a popular stopping place near Noble's Trail, just west of Shingletown. It was owned and operated by Charlie Ogburn. In 1856, Charlie sold the place to his brother John, who began holding bull and bear fights. The fighting arena was built of logs around a deep trench. Poles about 20 feet high were buried 3 feet in the ground, placed close together and securely nailed at the top. The arena was round and 60 feet across with a drop door, and the bear was prodded into the arena with hot irons where a bull was waiting for him. The spectators sat around on the outside of the stockade where they could look down on the fight on elevated seats. People came from as far away as Sacramento to attend the fights. The attendees numbered in the hundreds, and the betting was heavy. Want more Dottie Smith? Go to the Shasta Historical Society.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 at 1460 AM.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
A jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and heard online at KCNR1460.com, featuring Armstrong and Getty, both smart and funny. Plus, you will hear Dave Ramsey, Mark Levin, and Ben Shapiro. And don't miss our local programming right here on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Email the show at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Kelly Casimir, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale College. Dr. Casimir, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You recently gave an update to faculty here on campus about some of your research, a little lecture titled Drug Addiction at the Atomic Level. First, history. What does the history of drug abuse look like? Where do many of these drugs originate?
Yeah, sure. So human beings have been using and abusing psychoactive drugs for thousands of years. Really as far back as we can measure in civilization. So alcohol, for example, there's evidence of alcoholic beverages on pottery that are over 10,000 years old. There are 6,000-year-old breweries. So these are examples of pretty common drugs. Caffeine, for example, nicotine, these are all drugs that people maybe not don't come first to mind as being substances that are abused, but they've been used for thousands of years. I particularly study stimulants, cocaine and amphetamine, and these drugs are natural substances like most of our drugs. So human beings, for the most part, have identified substances from their environments as natural plant products, often watching animals and the effects that they have when animals imbibe. So substances like cocaine come from plant leaves, the coca plant, amphetamine, not exactly, but its precursor, ephedra, comes from the mahuang plant, which is a plant associated with traditional Chinese medicine. So historically speaking, indigenous populations would have been using these drugs from their environments. It really isn't until the mid-1800s where we have this kind of chemical revolution. We have the earliest organic chemists coming into the scene and identifying the active ingredients of these plants, purifying them, and then providing them to humans in a much more concentrated, more easy-to-abuse manner. So we have this kind of mid-1800s until around 1914 era, where it's the era of real Coca-Cola. and then around 1914, Harrison Narcotics Act, these drugs become illegal. That does not stop their use, of course. And a lot of the build-up, the popularity in these drugs have associations with the war efforts, so particularly World War II, use of stimulants, primarily amphetamines, are used regularly among both Axis and Allies. And then we have people coming home from war, and so we'll often see these traveling back to the States after wartime, both for World War I and Vietnam, and then we get, the epidemics that we're more familiar with in modern times in the 80s, 90s, and aughts. So,
you mentioned you focused your research on stimulants, cocaine, amphetamines. So how do those type of drugs affect the body?
Well, so the primary area that humans use these drugs for are for the effects on the brain, and all drugs of abuse. This includes stimulants, but opiates and, a variety of other abuse substances. What they tend to have in common is that they modify the activity of slash activate the chemical pathways in the brain that are associated with biogenic amines. So these are substances like dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, but particularly dopamine, that control attentiveness, arousal, so that's more acetylcholine, fear and stress responses, so that's more norepinephrine. Serotonin is going to control things that are, well-being related, and then you have dopamine. And this is, what's really common to all of these drugs is they tend to affect the dopamine pathways. And what dopamine does for the brain, what these signaling pathways do, is that they're what we call the value assessor for the brain. So what this means is, and this is a very Hillsdale thing, so the dopamine pathways are actually what teaches the brain what is good. And so the activity in these regions, while, let's say we're, under normal circumstances, living our normal lives, what we want our brain to learn is that we have, when we're very thirsty and we drink a cold glass of water, that is good. When we're very hungry and we eat a delicious and nutritious meal, like, that is good. Then that's where drugs come in. So let's say, I have learned that drinking water is good and eating food is good and, having positive reinforcement from my peers is good. But then I decide that I'm going to take cocaine. And, on the scale of water to social reinforcement to cocaine, well, cocaine has now dwarfed the importance of all the other things, because I'm not physiologically capable of even having the activity stimulation that would be, this is so outside the realm of normal that we've now completely reset our priorities. And so it is in these ways that we begin to start having problems with our decision making, because this center, this value center, it's both the structure of the brain, but also the function of the brain. For this center to be connected to all of our areas of learning and memory and decision making and behavior. And so now, as we're thinking about decision making, what we're saying, our brain is telling us, is that, you know what's good? Cocaine is good.
So you've done, again, your research on stimulants, cocaine, amphetamines. What has that research told you about possible treatment for the addiction to stimulants?
Many people are trying to work on developing the style of drugs to treat cocaine addiction, although we haven't really been successful in these areas. And so what my research does is to try to look at it in a slightly different way. Now, I'm a biochemist, and so I'm actually really interested in just how, like, the proteins in this system work, like, for their own benefit, right? Just to understand. But a consequence of this research, I'm hoping eventually might entail, if we really understand how the proteins that are involved in this work, so that would be things like the receptors that bind to the neurotransmitters that cause these effects. But my particular research is in a class of proteins called transporters, and these are the kind of cleanup proteins. So after a signaling event, they're pulling the neurotransmitters out of the synapse and terminating signaling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually these proteins that cocaine and amphetamine are directly interacting with. So cocaine specifically binds to and blocks these proteins, which does not let the neurotransmitters back up into the cell. So you get this elevated signaling by basically losing the ability to terminate. Amphetamine is much more insidious, because it actually, not only will it compete with the neurotransmitter, so you get more neurotransmitter in synapse, but it will go into the cell and through a variety of mechanisms actually cause the cell to dump even more neurotransmitter out. So what we're hoping is, if we really understand how these proteins, these transporters work, we could, for example, design a drug that would block the interactions between cocaine or amphetamine with these proteins. We could potentially block the kinds of signaling events that cause these downstream amphetamine effects, prevent the cell from releasing even more dopamine. And so the goal would be to try and design a drug that would maybe stabilize the protein in one orientation, where it would still function normally, but it would just be slightly turned down, or slightly, you know, instead of it having this very, you know, large ability to transition from going very slow to very fast, maybe we could just slow it down just a bit so that it could still be functional when we need it, but then would prevent some of the excessive signaling that we see with taking these sorts of drugs.
Mm. Interesting research from Dr. Kelly Kazmir, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Hillsdale College, talking drug addiction at the atomic level. Dr. Kazmir, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we talk with Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department about the school's Visiting Writers Program. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is the Cigar of the Month from Tobacco and Brew, brought to you by Liga Privada. The Underground Sungrown is the perfect balance of Nicaraguan long filler tobacco. Draped in a lovely Connecticut sun-grown wrapper, this stick received a 92 rating. With hints of spice, wood, and espresso, this robust cigar ends on notes of cinnamon. Come down to the best cigar shop around, Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Hi, this is Chuck Kenny with Shasta Gas Propane. It's been a while since I've cut a new radio spot, but I feel I need to issue a warning about energy prices during this fall winter of 2021 and 22. Just as Obama said after he was elected, elections have consequences. This winter, our country will suffer some of the consequences of the last election. I'm not a politician, but I am a businessman, and many of the decisions of this current administration will drastically affect energy prices this winter and going forward. Already we are experiencing record high propane costs and prices. Remember, our motto at Shasta Gas Propane is, our customers are warm friends. We will treat you like friends this winter and do our best to help you through this high price winter. Give us a call at 365-3793. That's 365-3793.
Turn your someday into today. The Shasta College spring semester begins January 19th, and now's the time to register for classes. First-time, full-time students, get your first 2 years tuition free. At Shasta College, we'll teach you the skills, give you the knowledge, and provide the training you need to unlock your potential. Reskill, upskill, or get transfer ready at Shasta College. Go to www.shastacollege.edu/apply.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide 3 delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Thirty years ago, Simpson University arrived in Redding with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Redding's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello and welcome to our new listeners on our brand new radio affiliate, the Hill Country Patriot. That's 104.3 FM and 102.1 FM in Kerrville, Texas. Thanks for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Dr. Dutton Carney, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College and also the Director of the Hillsdale Visiting Writers Program. Dr. Carney, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Excited to talk today about this really neat thing we have on campus. You have been the director now for a couple of years, the Hillsdale Visiting Writers Program, which brings some really neat people to campus to both work with and interact with our students. tell our listeners, what is the Visiting Writers Program?
Well, it started in 1994, so it's been around for over 30 years. I'm the third director of the program, and the idea behind it is to get a writer who's nationally recognized, who has a pretty solid track record, someone who's going to be compatible with our mission, who will present a reading one night, a lecture another night, say on poetry or on fiction, and then spend time with our students in workshops. The real value of the program is the fact that students get to spend time with these writers in workshops and in informal settings to learn tricks of the trade, what it's like to be a published writer, how they can further their own education, maybe get an MFA or something along those lines, to really lean on their experience, as opposed to the professors just kind of gathering around a particular writer.
If we back out a little bit and take a look at the writing program sort of writ large at Hillsdale, what does that look like? How many students generally are involved in that sort of thing?
Well, it's slowly been expanding over time. So I would say we usually have a core of 150 to 200 students who'll come out to listen to the lecture and the readings, and then a smaller group will attend workshops, anywhere between 15 and 20. Anything larger than that, then it starts to lose its efficacy. And then students who want to invite writers to their houses, in the evening, there are student stories that have spread through the years, and some legendary stories involving poets who have been here. But it's really an opportunity for them to see a working writer, mm-hmm. and get to know things that they're not going to be able to get from someone in academia, like myself or other people in the department.
I'll ask you for specific names in a moment, but when it comes to the people you want to see come to campus, how do you identify and then reach out and try to convince them, ask them to come to Hillsdale?
I'm reading constantly. So one thing that I like to do is to look at the short list for the National Book Award, for the Booker Prize, for the Pulitzer Prize, and read through those works. And the best thing to do is to catch someone who's up and coming. If someone who's established, really out of our price range. I was looking, when I first got on, I had George Saunders in a short story class in 2012, 2013, and he actually phoned in and talked to my students. Mm. So when I became director of the program, I thought, this is going to be great. Let's have him in. He's just won the Booker Prize. He has been regaled all over in book reviews, and so his price was definitely out of our orbit. But just try to find somebody who is talented, who would like to spend time with students.
I imagine that when writers are working with other writers, and in this case a published writer, it's a different interaction than they get with dealing with professors here on campus or dealing with other students here on campus. The ability and the opportunity to talk with these writers has to be a different sort of interaction for them.
It definitely is. It's more intimate. You can talk about the tricks of the trade, as it were, whereas academics are going to look at it from a more analytical perspective, and the writers are going to look at it from a creative perspective. And so they have insights that an academic just isn't going to have.
So we're talking with Dr. Dutton Carney here, Associate Professor of English, about the Hillsdale Visiting Writers Program. How many people generally come out during the course of a year here to Hillsdale? And then, yeah, give us some of those specific names. I know we've had some really interesting people here recently.
We definitely have. In the past, we would have two or three writers a year, usually around two. And Dr. John Somerville had a pretty wide network of writers. And a lot of them came in for an honorarium that was a little bit less than market value, but because they knew Dr. Somerville, they were fine to do it. So when I got it, it was clear that it might be better to have one big event as opposed to several. And so that's what I've focused in on. So the first writer that I was able to invite is was Chigozie Obioma, and he had been nominated for the Booker Prize with his novel The Fisherman, and then again for his novel An Orchestra of Minorities. And in fact, this past cycle, he was one of the five judges for the Booker Prize. So that was really exciting.
How do you judge and how do you evaluate the impact that this Visiting Writers Program has had through the years, going back, as you mentioned, 30 years now here at Hillsdale? What difference has it made here on campus?
You hear back from alums who went to a reading, really thought, well, all right, I'm going to do this for extra credit, or this poem intrigues me. And I didn't realize that what it had done is that it really planted a seed in the back of my mind. So last month we had two alums, one a short story writer and one a poetry writer, one who graduated in 2006 and one who graduated in 2016, and they both had mentioned that their participation in the program was an integral part of their education, and so they both went and got MFAs, and now they're both published writers, and it was really wonderful to have them back and to celebrate their accomplishments.
You've seen a number of these authors here on campus. Do you notice differences between I guess the genre of work that they do? Short stories, novels, poetry, different personalities or different quirks, anything you've picked up on over the years?
I would say yes. We had an essay writer, John Jeremiah Sullivan, who was here, and he had just published a really a feted book called Pulphead. I was talking to him at dinner, and I said, one thing that really is remarkable about all of your essays is that even if you write about somebody you don't like, you find something about that person to love, and then to center your essay around that desire to get to know the person even more. And his eyes just kind of opened up, and he said, "That's exactly what I try to do." And so you have poets who are just remarkably proficient with the entire tradition. Morris Manning was here, and he knew as much about lyric poetry as I did, and I had to do a double take. I thought, well, gosh, you write poetry, but he's also a student of it and a scholar of it. And then you have someone like Linda Gregerson, who knew much more about lyric poetry than I ever will.
How do you get involved with the students from a creativity perspective, where students need to find their own voice, their own style, and yet, you know, there are some, I don't want to say restrictions, but some things you still want to teach them and be able to help them. How is that different for each student?
Dana Joy was here, and what he said is that what you want to do is to cultivate the singular voice that's you. And when you do that, then when you possess your voice, then you can put it in dialogue with the tradition. You can find poets you like or authors that you like, particular forms that you like, but the voice that you will be unique and unrepeatable, and that's something that we always try to encourage here on the literary side, doing analysis and then learning the literary tradition. But I think it's everything is different when it comes from an actual poet who's doing the thing that the students wish that they could do eventually.
Talking with Dr. Dutton Carney about the Hillsdale Visiting Writers Program, they might be listening. If who would you like to have here on campus in the future?
Well, goodness. So one thing that's really nice is that writers who are here will recommend other writers.
Mm-hmm.
And one writer, she's living in Greece now, is A.E. Stallings, and her poetry really dovetails exactly with what we do in the liberal arts here, and especially in the classics department. Christopher Biha has written several novels, and he's the editor of Harper's Magazine, so I think something like that would be nice. And then, like a dream writer would be the Hungarian novelist Laszlo Krasznahorkai. He is just a remarkable writer, and I envision him winning some international prizes sometime soon. But then also there's practicality.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at other poets.
Dr. Dutton Carney, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College and Director of the Hillsdale Visiting Writers Program. Thank you for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you very much, Scott.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to John J. Miller, Director of the Dow Journalism Program, talking about his book, The Big Scrum and Safety in Professional Football. Peter Wood with his recent book, Wrath. Kelly Casimir from Hillsdale's Chemistry Department told us about drug addiction at the atomic level. And Dutton Carney from Hillsdale's English Department on the school's Visiting Writers Program. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You can also find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Cuddy Casimir this week, or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, and now iHeartRadio. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hi, this is Matt with Liberty Unabashed. It's time to embrace American values. Our society is based on the freedom, not begging the government for permission. It's time to wake up, my brothers and sisters. Come check out my show every other Sunday, 8 to 9, Liberty Unabashed.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
The YMCA is welcoming new members to come and enjoy the many choices the YMCA has to offer. The YMCA has a variety of fitness activities, including swimming, aqua aerobics, cardio, weights, group power classes, and booty yoga. There's over 100 classes to choose from. The YMCA is so much more than a gym. The Y is a community. Join the YMCA. 246-YMCA or go online to sfymca.org.
Wind River Resort and Casino's ultimate tailgate party is the talk of the town.
Football is life. Get in the game.
Sunday, February 13th in the Wind River Resort and Casino Event Center.
Score on food, drinks, party favors, prizes, and kickoff for cash.
Catch the big game on 5 large TV screens and 2 super-sized ones.
Must be 21 to attend this exciting event.
Game day buffet included with tickets. Doors open at 2 p.m.
Some people talk football. We live it at Wind River.
Tickets on sale at WinRiver.com.
Find your ultimate tailgate moment only at Wind River Resort and Casino.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere, Ag, and Turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Are you new to crypto? It can leave you feeling unsure of what to do. Help is available. From getting started to securing your cryptos, you don't need to go it alone. Bitcoin 530 will take you by the hand to help you move forward with your crypto journey. Schedule a free consultation with Bitcoin 530 at bitcoin530.io. Or give them a call at 530-324-5175. That's bitcoin530.io.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe, or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
A Moment in History, presented by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Briggsville is California Historical Landmark Number 7. It was an 1849 gold mining settlement beside Clear Creek, approximately 1 mile east of Horsetown, where early gold miner James Reagan supposedly took gold out by the panful. The town site was located by Ben Briggs and was first known as Breechesburg because the miners wandered around without wearing any breeches. When the first female resident, Mrs. Briggs, arrived, she demanded that the miners must wear breeches or she would leave. Not only did they begin wearing breeches, they named a town for her. Briggsville became the location of the Landrum and Briggs Toll Bridge across Clear Creek in the 1850s, as a stage stop for the Hall and Crandall stage line in 1853, and was the location of the Lean Hotel in 1860. A Moment in History, presented by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Want to get more Dottie? Go to the Shasta County Historical Society.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.